House come to order if members can take their seats.
This budget is a huge job maker, and the number one solution to economic insecurity is a job.
Hungry children can't learn, and it's our responsibility to try to help.
Equality and opportunity.
I believe most people are here because they want to do some good.
You've discovered a new episode of Capital Ideas, and if this is your first one, I'll just say you chose a great one to start with. But first things first, Capital Ideas is the podcast where members of the Majority Democratic Caucus in the Washington State House of Representatives sit down at the Capitol and talk about ideas. Those ideas invariably are about making the Evergreen State a better place to live, work, raise a family, walk in the woods, climb a mountain, start a business, fall in love, get well, buy groceries, be safe, and say what's on your mind. Things that matter. Now, today's guest on Capital Ideas is Everett State Representative Mary Fossey. In a little over a week, she'll wrap up her fourth session in the House, where she serves as Deputy Majority Floor Leader and Vice Chair of the Labor and Workplace Standards Committee. We'll talk about these things and plenty more, so sit back and get ready to meet a very interesting public servant. We recorded this conversation on Monday, March 2nd, 2026, and you'll hear it now. Welcome back to Capital Ideas, Representative Mary Fossey from the 38th Legislative District. That's Everett and Environs, and I appreciate you coming by.
Everett, Marysville, and Tulalip.
Three fine places. The last time you and I talked on Capital Ideas was almost exactly 3 years ago on February 20th, 2023.
Hot dog, has it been that long?
It has been that long.
Aww.
And now it is 2026. You're a hardened veteran of the legislature now. This is your fourth session. And I would like to find out what's different now that you've been around for a couple of biennia, as opposed to when you were a freshman?
That's an interesting question. Trying to think back, it's hard to remember back that far. But I think coming in to the legislature, I was really just on that, you know, steep learning curve. And I was, you know, quite successful right out of the gate for the first biennium with the amount of bills and budget things we were able to secure for the community. So a lot of those fights, you know, were really successful. And then we come to this session. I'm now in leadership as the Deputy Majority Floor Leader, and that provides a little different perspective, but it is also a much more challenging year with what's going on federally and trying to mitigate some of the harm, and then also the struggles with the budget. So, yeah.
That is one of the things that I want to ask you about is you are in leadership. You're the Deputy Majority Floor Leader, which is a big job. And you're also the Vice Chair of the Labor and Workplace Standards Committee. Ordinarily, a person either goes one way or they go the other in terms of kind of paths. So you're doing double duty, basically. How is that?
We have two vice chairs of the Labor Committee, and it's a passion area for me to really fight for working families and all the issues that workers are facing. And so I really, really enjoy the work. And I think having multiple, you know, leaders in that committee really helps with it. And it's not been extremely busy this year with the floor leader duties that are passed down to me. I mean, I get to work directly with the floor leader Stonier. And so, you know, that's another kind of teamwork situation. I would not say the floor leader in the interim as much work, perhaps, as, you know, bill development and, you know, working on other budget issues and some of the other federal focus work that I did this last session. So that's more of just kind of right during session, you know, pretty busy.
You mentioned being pretty successful in your first biennium with some of your bills, which is true. I think that you had a larger percentage maybe than a typical person in their first couple of years. Right now, as we sit here towards the end of the session, you have three bills that have made it out of the House and have been heard in the Senate and are now awaiting executive action. which means being voted do pass by a given committee so that they will hit the Senate floor. One of them is going on as we speak, and that may be, I'm just going to guess, that may be one of the bills that you feel the most strongly about, and that has to do with unpaid wages, or wage theft is another way of looking at that. First of all, can you define wage theft? How does that take place?
Wage theft can come in a variety of ways. Right now, Washington is the ninth worst state when it comes to wage theft in the nation. And they estimate every year over $600 million employers steal in wages from their workers. And that's really devastating when they don't pay them or they misclassify them and pay them less and all these different approaches they use to not pay their workers the paycheck that they've earned. Those really low-wage workers struggle to keep food on their table for their families and roofs over their heads. And so this approach was a very well negotiated policy solution that came out of a work group that was put together by legislation prior year. And so it had representatives from employers and representatives from worker side of things. And you had academia and you had agencies there. And so they all came to consensus that they wanted to help these low-wage workers that were struggling in going through this process, because it's a very long process and cumbersome to do the wage recovery. And so folks were waiting so long to actually get the dollars that they were owed that this provides, you know, a little stipend in the meantime to keep the roof over their heads and the food on the table. It's a really, really important bill. It's not the only solution to wage theft. There's other things that we can do and we should do. But this is one approach that is going to, you know, help with that quick Band-Aid for our working families in this wage theft crisis we're in.
And you mentioned low-wage workers. That's generally who is going to be targeted by wage theft, isn't it? It's mm-hmm. not going to hit the white-collar person sitting in a corner office.
It's usually the most vulnerable workers. And that's another frustrating thing, because when you're living paycheck to paycheck, it's very difficult to lose one of those paychecks, especially when you worked really hard for it. So this bill will help with that. I look forward to it moving on to pass the Senate, fingers crossed. But I had a couple of other bills, like the Child Care Workforce Board. And so that'll be a pretty impactful legislation if we can get that through this year.
How's that going to work?
So the Workforce Board, everyone knows that we're in a child care crisis right now.
Yes.
And one of the main contributors to that is that we underfund our child care workforce, and they are stretched so thin that providers going out of business because they can't find workers because pay is terrible. There's not a future trajectory there as a career, and we are just not taking care of the workforce that is taking care of our future. And so this will actually put together people that are seeing this child care crisis up front and have their voices at the table. That's everybody from, you know, the parents to the workers to the providers and agencies. And we're all talking together about recommendations that they should give to the legislature on what needs to change. What do we need to do better to make sure that we have this workforce and that childcare can become affordable and accessible?
So is this going to be an outfit that returns to the legislature with some recommendations?
They don't do any rulemaking. So previous versions of the policy had a little bit more authority put in there, but with more authority also costs more money. So this is a little bit easier approach to like get those recommendations from the folks that are directly experiencing the crisis on the front line and then have recommendations that they can provide to us to legislate solutions on, hopefully in the future. But that's not the only policy that I've been pushing hard for. There was one that didn't quite make it past the finish line. That one was a little bit sad because it was a really, really, really popular one as well.
What's that? Because next year is another year.
Yes, and I'm going to bring it back. It was the surveillance pricing bill. So the Fair Grocery Pricing and Transparency Act. And what that was it looked at how, I don't know if you've seen some of the news reports out there of certain grocery entities charging prices differently to different consumers. So, you know, you can go online and buy your groceries and then all of a sudden your neighbor does and you get the same exact thing and you get charged something completely different.
I had no idea.
Yeah. So it turns out that they can actually go and look at your web browser history and they can look at, you know, other demographics and all this information that they collect and create these profiles on you and charge you different prices. There's no law that's preventing that. And so you could also just be walking down a grocery aisle and then the person that's walking, you know, behind you, that grocery tag on these electronic shelf labels that a lot of stores are moving into can change by who's walking by them because they track you on your phone. And it's really like a nefarious use of AI. It's something that's developing so fast that we really need to put some guardrails on it. The FTC was doing a study recently on it, but everything kind of got, you know, put a kibosh on as, you know, things have been changing.
Right. Now, is this based on information that they have from the customer loyalty programs?
Oh, so the customer loyalty programs, I mean, there's so much data that's out there. There's data brokers that sell this information, you know, from everywhere. I think as a nation and as a state, we're really far behind on what we're doing to protect people's private data and the information that's being consumerized and monopolized on. We need to get in front of some of these nefarious ways that companies are exploiting consumers. And this bill was specifically targeting grocery, your essentials that you buy, making sure that it was fair because you shouldn't be paying, you know, more for baby formula or these other things just because they know you have to buy it and they have all these algorithms that are telling them, you know, we know that this person could pay this much. They would pay this much if you charge them this. Where if the next person, they know what their limit is, so they charge them that. Eventually, what that ends up doing is it closes down all the grocery stores in poor areas because they don't make enough profit. And then that's what the AI is calculated to do, all these algorithms, is to focus on the highest profit models.
So welcome to late stage capitalism. It's very interesting that you bring this up because the last podcast interview that I did, which will be the next one that gets posted online, was with Representative Shelley Kloba.
Oh, yes.
Who is a stalwart in fighting for data privacy.
Oh, yes. And I was so sad to see that her like policy that we desperately needed, just couldn't get it past the finish line again.
Its time is coming.
Yeah, it is. I think that's something where eventually there's going to just continue to be news stories out there and other things by good journalists out there exposing what's going on and bringing awareness to these issues that eventually the people are just going to make it so we have to pass these things and that everyone has to get on board and start protecting consumers.
Let's talk about another one of your bills, and that would be House Bill 1069, Supplemental Retirement Bargaining. What does that bill do?
Yeah, so let's look specifically at corrections officers. It's a very difficult, emotionally and physically draining job. And you would think that, okay, you work these, you know, jobs in public service for so long, you should be eventually able to retire with dignity. But what we're seeing is that they could not afford health care before they hit, you know, that Medicare age. So they are working into their mid-60s, 70s, and oftentimes getting to the point where they can't even have a retirement party before they pass on because they're still working these jobs. And so this allows for them to bargain over supplemental benefits. These benefits are things that, you know, perhaps their union could provide and that it can make that gap time period so they don't have to continue working into unsafe ages, that they can actually, you know, retire with dignity and spend all these years working so hard to be able to actually go then spend a little bit of time with their family. It's a good bill. I'm hoping it'll make it past the floor. I think it might have some amendments on it, so we'll have to come back to the House again, but they're small, so fingers crossed on that one too.
I'm going to guess that that would be a policy that not only would aid these workers, but also would encourage younger people to get into that particular line of work.
Well, yeah. I mean, with most things, when it comes to being part of a unionized workforce and being able to collectively bargain and create these better careers that are more satisfying and inviting, every career like that, I think, actually has a little bit of better turnout, in my opinion.
Tell me where and how you became a union activist. I like to talk to members about why a particular thing seems to be closely identified with them. Even though, you know, you sponsor bills on various things, you have different areas of expertise, but that's the one that if somebody said, well, you know, what about Mary Fossey? What's her deal? I think that labor would be the first thing out of their mouth. Why?
Well, that's neat. So my mother was a single mom, and growing up, you know, we struggled, and there were times where we were homeless when I was a kid. And when I was 9 months old, that was the first time I joined the picket line with my mom. And she ended up being 30 years CWA, Communication Workers, because she was a telephone operator. And there were times that she was laid off from her job. One time, she had just had a baby. And the baby, unfortunately, at birth, it passed away. And her job fired her for not coming back to work right away. They said, because you don't need to have maternity leave because you don't have a baby. And so they fired her, and her union got her job back. But that time when I was 9 months old, she was fighting just to have benefits for her kids. And so all these different little steps of fairer treatment, better pay, care for her kids, all these little things were fights that her union would stand up for her in, you know, solidarity. And that eventually brought us out of poverty. You're just talking about, you know, end stage capitalism a little bit earlier. I think the force and the power of the working class when we unite and we come together is really what is going to save this nation. And all the things that we're seeing and all the, like, you know, the nefarious corporation practices, like, you know, surveillance pricing and all these other things that are done in a way to exploit people. When we look at, you know, unions and workers' rights and working families and what we're fighting for, that is how we push back. So I see the value in that, and I think that's why I'm often out supporting my fellow working class folks on picket lines and whatnot and fighting for these issues, because I think that's how we actually have a middle class in the United States. It's really the only way.
3 years ago when we talked, you said that being a member of the House of Representatives was your dream job. Mm-hmm. Is it still?
Yeah, this is a place where you can really make an impact on people's daily lives, like directly. You can do so much here, make so much change. I think the only caveat I have to that, maybe after being here for a while, is that there does need to be some changes to the system. This institution wasn't made for parents, especially, you know, working families with young folks. It wasn't made for people that may come from more economically challenged backgrounds. The salary here, it's a very much full-time job that takes you away from your family. You have to do a lot of commuting. The salary here is for a part-time salary, but I don't think interim was a break last year. And it's getting more and more like that, especially with remote access, where these are starting to become like really, really full-time jobs and then some for most legislators. And it's very challenging, even though you have this impact for your community and you are able to do so many amazing things, you kind of gotta make that choice of these condensed schedules in spring and not seeing your family and not being able to go to your kids' recitals, not having any sort of break because we're still operating on outdated rules. It would be much easier if we broke it up and we had half of the session in the spring and then half of the session in the fall. It would be easier for staff too. It would be better for policy, honestly, because then we could be able to stakeholder in between and fix things a little bit better. I think we do need to modernize our institution, our system a little bit better to make it so that we are able to keep people here that actually represent the people, because it's really challenging to do that with the way this institution works. I think the people here are great, but a lot of them don't stay because it's just really challenging. It's hard to support a family of four on $70,000 a year, and when you're having to commute and be away from home for months at a time.
I want to take this opportunity to mention something that I think a lot of people either don't understand or they've never even heard it, which is lawmakers have exactly zero impact on what their salary is. Your salary is set by an independent salary board. even if you disagreed with how much it was and you wanted it to be lower, you don't have the ability to have them do that. And you certainly don't have the ability to have them raise your pay. I know why that was set up. I guess it works. But the fact is, I think a lot of people, when they hear a lawmaker talking about their salary, they might think, well, you know, those people, they make a lot of money and, you know, they're just in charge of their own purse strings.
People are here because of the passion for the work and the job and the love of policy. We have a lot of nerds here, a lot of really like do-gooder people that, you know, we're community advocates. And, you know, that's my background is like community advocacy. So it's like we're not here for the money. The money is not here. But we're seeing a lot of change with the demographics and the folks that are coming in, but it's hard for them to stay. And I think that's eventually something our state is going to have to grapple with. But because the size of our economy that we have in Washington State, the amount of trade we do, the amount of work we do, and the changing times means that we should probably modernize our institution and look at it a little bit differently.
Good luck.
I like challenges.
Mary, we've been talking for 24 minutes and 55 seconds. Mm-hmm. I think this is about how long I've got on your schedule. Mm-hmm. But before we leave, what else? Do you have a parting thought here or another topic you want to bring up? Because I can be here as long as you want.
Well, we didn't really talk too much about the budget.
No, we didn't.
Mm-hmm. And I know that the budget is kind of still in the works. We're waiting for that kind of negotiation to happen between the House and the Senate. But, you know, fingers crossed, there are a few things that I am hoping for to come to pass for our district as well as just generally in the budget. There's all the high level things that folks are fighting for is to, you know, maintain as much funding as we can on childcare and make sure that we're supporting people's essential needs and keeping folks alive. But a couple of the things that are also in there that I'm hoping that the negotiation plays out so that some portion remains was some housing in our district. Fingers crossed that some of those planning dollars stay in the budget. And then I'm looking at a tribal compact school that I'm hoping makes it through or some portion does, because there's a really, really win-win negotiation happening right now with the Marysville School District and the Tulalip Tribes. And this could be a really impactful project if the legislature helps with it. So we have some other ones to help a lot of our COFA communities that we have for some of folks with unique immigration statuses that have legal rights to work here to assist them with some challenges. And that's been a kind of a priority project of mine. There's another one that is kind of a less sexy topic that if you're really in the weeds on looking at some of the federal cuts and some of the federal actions that have been causing harm to our communities, and this one in particular, there's something that we do when it comes to worker safety on job sites. In particular, UW helps train these inspectors to go out and ensure that these jobs, they're statutorily mandated to. These are very important programs and education that we have, and there's so many things that are being cut at the federal level, and I think that this is one of those things that if this program dies because of a lack of funding, it will be something where people will die. Workers will die, and we can't have that, and it doesn't immediately pop into people's minds when you see people's food assistance being cut, children not having food, like that is a huge priority, but we can't forget about all these other devastating areas that are being impacted by what the feds are doing. This summer, I was the coordinator for the federal focus work groups, working with my caucus and everybody to really take a look at what these different cuts and these different actions of the federal government are doing, the impact that they're having on our communities. And that's everything from, you know, cutting food assistance and cutting these safety net programs to unreasonably extra burden, very inefficient rules and requirements being put on governments to run these types of programs, healthcare and immigration policies, like all these different things that are really causing like devastating effects that we're having to mitigate. And I think it helped us prepare a lot for this session and what our needs are and what we need to focus on. So I think it did have a positive impact, but my goodness, there is so much coming down that pipeline, and there is so much we're having to mitigate. And that is another reason why it's very tough to say that we are at a point now we have to wait, you know, another 9 months to be able to do anything about what's to come.
And I should point out something that I've been remiss in not mentioning in the last few podcasts that have aired, a lot of members are talking about the federal cuts to state government. If you hear that from one angle, you might think, well, you know, they're taking away some gifts. But the fact is, the federal money that comes to Washington, more money goes to Washington, D.C., from this state than comes back in any given year.
It's our tax dollars.
Exactly. We're a donor state. It's not an even balance.
Yeah. We give a lot of money to them in our tax dollars. And so our values of where we want these things to go, like we want to pay for FEMA for when we have emergencies going on. We want to make sure that healthcare is actually affordable and everyone's taken care of because it's more expensive not to. Like all of these different places where we think it's valuable to actually feed children. All the long-term ROI on some of these policies are really, really smart approaches, like beyond just the humanity of them, they're smart approaches. And it's very, very difficult when we pay all these tax dollars and all of a sudden we just get cut off and treated so poorly by the federal government.
Mary, I am very sorry it's been 3 years since the last time we talked.
I know. Let's do this more often.
Let's do this more often. I apologize for having made it take so long, but I'm really glad you came back. This has been Capital Ideas with Representative Mary Fossey from Everett, Washington. Thank you for coming by and giving us a half hour of your time.
Thank you so much.
That, fellow Washingtonians, was Representative Mary Fossey, and that puts the wrap on another episode of Capital Ideas. If you're not a subscriber to our podcast, now's your chance. You'll never miss another episode, and that's good because this is your state government, and what happens here is more important now than ever before. I'm Dan Frizzell for the Washington State House Democrats, working together for One Washington since November 11th, 1889. Thanks for your time.